For those who care to join, let's open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. The most important part of the meeting, newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. And you can either wave at the camera if it's on or virtually raise your hand, or you're welcome to message one of the co-hosts. I do not see any hands, but if you're shy, please feel free to shoot a message to one of the co-hosts. We'd be glad to set you up with some phone numbers if you like. All right. I have asked Kendra to read the AA preamble, and real quick, I'm going to pull that up. One second. Kendra, you're still muted.
Okay, am I unmuted now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, sorry about that, y'all.
No worries.
Okay, I'm Kendra. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks for letting me read.
Thanks, Kendra. All right. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. And this evening, we are discussing Step 1, Part 1. Step 1 is admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And to the best of your ability, please join me in welcoming our panel this evening. We have Debbie and Malcolm. Yay! Thank you guys so much for being here. All right. So how this will work is I will read the first paragraph, which tonight can be found on XXVI in the doctor's opinion. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. So let me get that pulled up. Bear with me. All right. XXVI. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And tonight, we're starting with Malcolm.
Thank you, BJ. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
My name is Malcolm, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 18th, 2016. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group. Actually, Simple Actions is now my home group. I joined last week. I loved liquor. Started drinking beer and wine, but you know, the how things taste and their quality is definitely of secondary importance. What mattered to me was how effective it was, how quickly it could get me drunk. And so that means liquor. And you know, if I could only take one thing, if I could choose only one thing, it'd be vodka. Vodka seems discreet. Vodka can find a way to accommodate any situation, anything going on. I really, really loved vodka. I did not learn this at home. Neither of my parents had problems with alcohol. They were both medical professionals. They understood very well what alcoholism was. They would occasionally talk about it. This colleague or that patient, some relatives were thought to quote unquote drink too much, and they understood the difference between a heavy drinker and an alcoholic. My father's sister died of cirrhosis of the liver. They acknowledged, was an alcoholic. The thing is, though, they were Episcopalians, and the rumors are true. You know, wherever four Episcopalians gather, you know, a fifth is on the way soon. And it was a social lubricant, and not being able to drink at all carried some social stigma with them. If someone came to one of their dinner parties and drank nothing, it wasn't good. They were assumed to have a problem with alcohol. It's kind of strange. No alcoholics in my immediate family. My siblings were, this was at a time when a lot of recreational drugs were becoming available for the first time. And my siblings several of my siblings were getting involved in this. I'm the youngest of 10. 10 kids spread over two households, a few blocks apart. And they just seemed to be having just a terrific time. They were having a lot of fun, and I arranged to be like them just as soon as I could. I smoked weed before I drank. Friends introduced me to Mad Dog, Mogan David 2020, and beer when I was around 14. I was 14. Where I came from, there was a distinction made between the kind of beer you could get in the grocery store and the kind you had to go to a liquor store to get. And it was stronger, the stuff you got from the liquor store. And if you could find someone who would get that for you, then that was a good day. This was not something I did very frequently, though, but it was noticed right away by my friends that whenever I drank, I just got completely wasted. And it actually was frustrating for them sometimes, because I would get so drunk so fast that they'd have to, like, you know, do something with me. And this would cause the evening to end earlier than you know, everyone would have to go home before they wanted to. There was an incident when I was in high school. The incident at the Red Dragon Inn, the Red Dragon was a restaurant and had a nice parking lot behind it. And it was shaded from the street lights. And we would go back there and party, drink beer and smoke weed. And you know, usually we had enough sense to keep it quiet so that we could, you know, we could continue on. But one night, I don't think I was the only one who was making trouble, but the cops showed up, and I don't remember any of it. I mean, I was completely wasted. But the significant thing here is that the cops told my mother that of anyone there, and there were some older kids there, there were some college age kids there, of anyone there, I was in the worst shape. I was incoherent. She roused me out of bed the next day. You know, I didn't get a break from school or anything like that. I mean, that wasn't how my mother rolled. But she told me that this is something, that was the first time anyone had said anything to me about this, that this was something that I might want to keep an eye on. That she gave me the story, which I'd heard before, about my aunt who died of cirrhosis and said, this is, you know, you don't want to be the kind of person who can't drink. So watch it, you know, let's not let this happen again. I was an anxious kid, even at a young age, and it got worse at puberty. And alcohol just worked beautifully to smooth everything over. It just made me feel the anxiety just melted away. It made me feel all tingly and happy. And you know, if you're the kind of person who focuses on how he's feeling about things all the time, something that will make me feel better, well, that was all the power I thought I needed. Debbie?
All right. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Debbie. And hello to my people. It's so good to see everybody. You know, I've already got decisions I got to make. Do I just stare at myself so that I remember to mute and unmute myself? Or do I look at Malcolm? You know, I got things happening over here. I got two big books and a notebook in my lap because God knows I don't know how to talk about this first step. But anyway, that's my brain and how it works still today. My sobriety date is October, not my birth date. My sobriety date is October 24th, 1982. And my home group is Simple Actions, and I love my home group. So, you know, I don't talk about step one a lot. I don't think about step one a lot. I don't think about drinking. I've been sober a lot longer than I drank. I only drank for about 10 years. I was 27 when I got sober, and I like talking about sobriety, but I do talk about drinking. You know, if there's a newcomer, I'm sure. You know, we called them drunkalogs. If I'm sharing my drunkalog or if I'm qualifying, I got sober in Baltimore and there was just some different terminology they used back then. And so anyway, I love the doctor's opinion. You know, this is, at Simple Actions, we break step one into 2 weeks, and the first week's physical and the next week will be mental. And y'all can already tell by my introduction that my mental is still a little twisted. So the physical part, you know, that's pretty easy, although I fought it. I remember, I don't think any of us say, hey, I'm going to AA today. I'm going to get this thing straightened out. I'm going to turn my life around and things are going to be jolly. I was sent here by the suggestion of a judge. And I knew when I started going to meetings and I heard this thing about the first drink gets you drunk. I had already figured that out before I even walked into an AA meeting. Now, I didn't say it in those words, but I already knew from my drinking, like this talks about here, that once I take a drink, I'm going to take another drink, and I'm going to take another drink, and I'm going to take another drink. And so when I read this in here, once I decided I was one of y'all and I want to stick around, because when I first got here, I was too young, too smart, and too pretty. You know, this couldn't be for me. And I love Malcolm's share because my father was an alcoholic. He died at 51. My sister's an alcoholic. My brother's an alcoholic. Now my dad never got sober, but my sister and brother are sober. I was the first one to get sober. And I used to feel like I just haven't suffered enough because I'm the shining star out of the three of us. And so, I used to feel like I just need to drink some more. I need to suffer some more because I, I got, I was going to nursing school when I got sober, and I love this line in here. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, talking about the definition of an allergy and how we respond to alcohol. And I still laugh at that when I read that line, because my opinion is the only opinion that mattered when I was deciding if I was an alcoholic or not. I don't care if he's a doctor. I don't care what he's saying. I was a nursing student. I would read everything I could. This was the early 80s. There was a lot of information about alcoholism out there. There was, you know, you couldn't walk a block without hitting a rehab or a detox. And I went to a lot of meetings at those places, and I would hear stories. You know, I was in nursing school in downtown Baltimore at University of Maryland, and I would hear some horrendous stories of alcoholism that kind of confirmed what I thought was, you know, it's the old man sitting in the gutter with the brown coat and a brown paper bag. Not me. And so what I learned, though, from coming to these meetings is that my body's different. My body is different than the people around me who, to my eye, looks like they're drinking like I'm drinking. I still love drunks today. I love sober ones. I love drunk ones. I don't really know any social drinkers. I had no reason to know any, I guess. I don't know. I was a barroom drinker. I was married to the Budweiser beer truck driver. I was a bartender. I secured my supply. And so I just love alcoholics. And so when I started hearing some stories, you know, I lived in Baltimore County, and I started going to some meetings where I could start identifying a little bit more and kind of change that definition of, no, I don't have to live under the bridge to be an alcoholic. And I would start identifying with, oh, once I take a drink, I've never taken two drinks in my life. To me, that is hell. If I take one drink and I'm separated from it, that's hell. It's like, I would rather not drink the one. I wouldn't drink the one if I thought that I wasn't going to be able to get drunk. You know, I'll share briefly. My first drink was at the Twin Drive-In in Virginia Beach, and we had beer, and they said, if you drink it through a straw, you'll get drunk quicker. And I said, give me the straw, because that's all I want to do is get drunk. I'm not interested in the taste. I'm not interested in any, I don't know that stuff. I know I want to get falling down drunk, and I'm a blackout drinker from the get-go. I like that, because then the next day it's like, I don't know what I did. But anyway, so that's a whole lot of talking about my story, but what this paragraph says to me is that my body reacts differently than a non-alcoholic's body once I put that alcohol in it, and that explains to me why I keep drinking, and I'm going to take another one. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. Our next reading is page XVIII. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Malcolm?
Thank you, BJ. I'm going to keep asking you if you can hear me, because I've had problems with this. Am I good?
You sound great. Yes, sir.
Okay, thanks. Malcolm, alcoholic. So about 12 years into my drinking. This is still just an occasional thing. I don't know that I have ever started drinking and not finished the job, not gotten drunk. But first 12 years, I had a lot of distractions. Sorry, that sound you hear is a cat trying to break in here. There were a lot of distractions. I had a little trouble with powder cocaine in my early 20s. Call it a couple of times a week, you know, which is pretty frequent, but it just wasn't the issue. So about 12 years after I took my first drink, I'm sort of at a threshold moment, and the frequency of my drinking's increasing somewhat. But in spite of that, it's hard to explain. I don't know about the relationship, but I was getting a lot of positive feedback from different directions. I had returned to school. I was doing well. My job was nothing special, but I could handle it while I finished school. And I had just a very charming girlfriend and an active social life, mostly on the strength of having the charming girlfriend. And she was really airing me out. We were, I'm not someone who is energized by contact with other people. I've never been an especially sociable person, but she was really, really, loosening me up. And we were going to concerts and to parties. I always hated parties, but I still felt that's where I should be, is at a party getting drunk. But I always hated them, but it was okay when I was with her, camping on Ocracoke, just having a wonderful time. And again, a lot of positive feedback from different directions. And this sounds, like a cop out, but it was as if my drinking became more frequent, so almost to keep pace with my social life. And I started to get drunk pretty much every evening. And this went on for a while, and there really wasn't any consequence for this. And then I noticed I was feeling really awful in the morning, and a shot or two would fix me up, and I wouldn't feel like I needed to drink anymore until later in the evening. I thought, okay. And then I am waking up in the early hours of the morning with just these nightmarish thoughts and very sick and shaking and cold sweats, all that, and alcohol fixed that. And you get the picture. In a matter of months, I had graduated to full-blown alcoholism, and the charming girlfriend expressed concern. She said, this isn't going anywhere good. What's up? You should deal with this. And it got worse, if such thing could be imagined. Somehow I was staying in school and holding down a job, but I started sleeping in like 2 or 3 hour, I would just get 2 or 3 hours of sleep at a time. And, it's possible really to get drunk 2 or 3 times a day. I mean, you never really sober up. So that's maybe not an accurate way to describe it, but if you sleep for a little while, if you take a break, take a nap, then when you wake up, you can get that rush again. And that's what I started doing. And it's really that the timeline of those days is unclear to me, but I do remember kind of coming to one day and realizing that I had not spoken to or seen my girlfriend in over a month. And it was I was drunk round the clock at that point. I had a little apartment over near the Narrow Theater on Colley Avenue, and I would watch the crowds leaving the theater from this apartment. It was like sort of like an observation tower. I was just watching life go by. I only left that apartment to get food or liquor, and I had the kind of job where I could conceal it. I would leave for work, but I wasn't working as much as I was supposed to be. And so somehow still made it, still did okay, well enough to stay in school. But I had this crazy idea that I could, I was always losing my clock. This was before phones did everything. And my clock was always, I don't know, under a pile of dirty laundry or you know, some, you know, went on the shelf in the closet, you know, I'd find it in strange places. And I would sometimes wake up, and if it was after dark and there was no alcohol in the house, then I would need to determine that what time it was, because I might need to get to the liquor store. If there was no alcohol in the house, I would definitely need to get to the liquor store. And I had this idea that I could tell just from the behavior of the people, the crowds leaving the theater, you know, how many of them there were, whether it was the early show or the late show. And if it was the late show, then I needed to get myself together and get to the liquor store before it closed. I would just kind of come to in a panic. And the only thing that would calm me down is more alcohol, and rinse and repeat. That's all I've got for now. Thank you.
Thanks, Malcolm. I'm still trying to figure out if I smoked pot first or drank first, because that kind of caught my ear when you shared that a minute ago. And I remember my first drink. I don't remember my first pot. And I don't consider myself a drug addict. Maybe that's why, I don't know. But it was easier to get pot when you're a teenager than stand in front of or behind the 7-Eleven going, hey, mister, can you buy me some whatever? And so I dated the guy that grew the pot along the 5-mile stretch out in Virginia Beach, because I guess I was just someone who protect my supply from day one, you know, because there was never enough. And it was always going to be, it was going to run out. And that was my fear. But so this paragraph brings that phenomenon of craving into the picture. I just like the sound of that. I mean, that sounds dramatic. And I like drama, you know, I like chaos. And so, again, it's talking about this allergy. And like I said, I'm a nursing student. I'm a know-it-all. I'm smarter than any of you in there. And I know what an allergic response is, and this ain't it. And so what I had to learn was that the allergy in my body is that I just have an abnormal response to this substance than, like I said, another person. Like if my mother drank it, who was the only sober one among us, she would not have that response. She wouldn't even finish one. It's like, what's wrong with you that you won't drink that drink? But anyway, and it tells me this never occurs in the average temperate drinker. It's only us alcoholics that occurs in. And again, I knew right away what that craving was, that I couldn't explain it, but I just knew my brain was gonna tell me, and that gets more into the mental part of it, but my brain was gonna tell me, you need to have another drink. Another drink sounds like a real good idea. And yet another drink sounds like a real good idea. And so it starts talking about, towards the end of that paragraph, the hopelessness of this thing. You know, and when I first come around AA, I don't think I'm there yet. I don't think that I'm hopeless. I think I still have choice. Like I said, I was a bartender and I was a full-time student. You know, my problems were piling up on me. I can't remember what we read and haven't read, but you know, I had a strong tolerance to alcohol, and that was kind of changing. It was getting a little unpredictable, and I was starting to get really vomiting a lot, which I was real proud of that I never did, never had hangovers, never vomited. Well, that was changing, and bile was introduced into the picture, and what is this green stuff coming up? And, you know, DWIs were getting in the picture. My problems were definitely piling up. I'm getting divorced, but I still think I have a choice. I still think I have a choice, because I never drank every day. I never did. I was very busy. And so I would tell myself, I'm just going to drink on the weekend. So Friday and Saturday. And then I would drink Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then I'd say, okay, I'm not going to drink until Friday, and I'm drunk Thursday. And so then AA intervened. And so I never became a daily drinker. I think that if AA hadn't intervened, that I would have. I think it was definitely heading that way. But when I first came around, I still thought that I could choose when I took that first drink. I didn't think I had any choice once I took the first drink. And again, that next week when we talk about the mental, it's going to tell me why I no longer have that choice. because the next paragraph we read, I'll talk about that. I mean, it describes my alcoholism to a T. But so this phenomenon of craving and knowing that it only occurs in alcoholics, it saved my life, because I would have just compared myself out of here. Because if this is all I need to know is that I can't, I want to, let me get my other book. I got two books. So I pulled out my original third edition big book that's falling apart and went to read the doctor's opinion, because what did I think then back in 1982? And what I wrote was, I can't drink safely. I can't keep from drinking, and I'm powerless over alcohol. And it really is that simple, but I will just complicate the heck out of it when I'm a newcomer. You know, today I know that all I need to know is that I have this phenomenon of craving, and only alcoholics have that. That's enough on that one. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. We are still on the same page, XXBIII. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented until they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Malcolm?
Yes, thanks, BJ. Low points, bottoms weren't like really threshold moments for me. I kind of got used to them. I drank for a long time. I had low points, like low points on a sinus rhythm. You know, I'd been there before, and I knew there was more to come after that. I just tried to rally, you know, every time. Before I actually was drinking on a daily basis. I had a job opportunity fall into my lap. I really wasn't qualified for this job, but I had connections. I knew the boss. I knew the people in management, and they wanted me to give it a shot, and so I did. And I thought that I was on my way. I couldn't believe how lucky I was. It was noticed that I didn't have such great attention to detail. My paperwork was a mess all the time. But on the other hand, I garnered a reputation for developing a close emotional rapport with the clientele and creative solutions and insight and the paperwork was they spoke to me about it, and they just hoped I'd get better. And this was a big deal. One of my coworkers was getting married and decided to invite everyone working there to the wedding. And we all drove up there, one, and just a whole car full of us, several cars full, but up to the bride's family home in Western New York. And it was this great, big, boisterous, cheerful, hard-drinking Irish Catholic family. She had 15, the bride, my coworker, had 15 siblings. And the mother, the matriarch of this thing, I mean, you know, her word was, you know, whatever she said, that was how things were done. And she just loved me. She thought it was just, she thought I was really, really cool. Most of my coworkers were women, and this person thought, the matriarch thought it was just really something that I could, that I was doing so well in a situation like that. These are kind of old fashioned people, but hard drinkers. The wedding reception was at the family home, and there was an open bar, and they were serving great big slugs of some kind of actually pretty good whiskey. And, it just kept coming. It just kept flowing, and they were very generous. And, you know, I should have said before, if there are any children possibly in earshot, that you may want to ask them to step out in a moment. But toward midnight, I really don't, I don't remember anything like a decision-making process in this. Toward midnight, fortunately, some people had gone home, but there was still a pretty sizable crowd. And this crowd was treated to the spectacle of me having sex with one of the bridesmaids on the lawn under the kitchen window of the house. It's quite an uproar. I heard about this later. A couple of the brothers were about to turn the garden hose on us and had to be restrained, physically restrained. The matriarch is in tears. She's just shattered. You know, shocking a big boisterous Irish Catholic, hard drinking Irish Catholic family is not necessarily an easy thing to do. And I could check that box. You know, I don't have a clear memory of it. I remember looking up into the branches of a tree in the kitchen window. The light from the kitchen was lighting up these branches. I guess I was lying on the ground. That's, that's me, right? Always the gentleman. Anyway, the ride back home was, you know, talk about awkward. No, it was, you know, in stark contrast to the ride up, it was, no one was talking to me. They were talking to each other. They would occasionally direct comments toward me like, "You're disgusting," and "Dude, there's twigs in your hair." I still had a little hair then. This was quite some time ago. And you know, nothing was the same after work. I mean, what had been overlooked before, what they'd let slide before, they focused on it from there on out. Basically, everyone liked me before, but they did not like me afterward. Really, that's all that was. This is an important part of why I got that job. And so when that was gone, they let me resign a few months later. Look, this is something that I wanted. I really wanted to make this work. And if you had told me the morning of that day that I would have been capable of such a thing, I would have told you you were crazy. Debbie?
All right, I got to watch which buttons I hit because I lost y'all there for a minute, but I'm back. Anyway, I just want to know if the bridesmaid made it to AA, because I'm sure I would end up sponsoring her. I can relate to that woman. Anyway, so this paragraph is, we all love it. We all love the effect produced by alcohol. What I love about this paragraph, it says that, you know, we can't differentiate the truth from the false, but I love that their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I mean, that's why I drank, because once I drank, I mean, I could be on the way to the bar and I'm already relaxing a little bit because I know there's relief in sight, that this brain is going to settle down. Whatever that stupid book was, I'm okay, you're okay. That's how I felt in the bar. I am okay, and even you're okay. I don't even have to take your inventory or figure out what's wrong with you. Everything is just okay. And I just loved that effect. Now, I would say I'd overshot the mark, except that was my goal. I wanted to overshoot the mark. I just never kidded myself that I wanted to just drink one or two, you know, I just wasn't that drinker. But anyway, I love this explanation of, you know, we succumb to the desire again. The phenomenon of craving develops. I pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And that's my story. That's my story. Over and over, I would just do the same thing again. And again, it's talking about the hopelessness of my being able to do anything, you know, that I think that's one of the reasons I don't like step one meetings a lot, because we just, I can sometimes leave a step one meeting feeling yucky. It's like, where's the solution? And so if you're new, there is a solution. We just have to get the identification part down that if you're new, you can figure out, do I belong here? Am I one of you? And so, it's interesting to me, and I'm not here to qualify drugs or alcohol or whatever your thing is your thing, but I would do whatever you laid in front of me. I dated the cocaine dealer, so I did some cocaine. Whatever. I'm glad I didn't date a heroin dealer. I think I'd be dead today if I did. But that effect in my brain, the whole mental thing of that was a whole different response in my body than alcohol was. I wanted to get wasted on alcohol. I didn't like what happened to my brain with the other stuff. I thought that I was never going to get back to not high. and I know some people love that, and that's okay. If that's your thing, that's your thing. But just in case there's somebody out there that just can't relate to that, I just like to throw that out there, because as you can tell just from your two speakers tonight, our histories are varied. But our reaction, that's what's so important about the doctor's opinion, is that all the consequences and the outside, you know, the things that happen to us, all I need to know is what happens to me when I take a drink and I take another drink. That's what happens to me. Thanks.
Thank you guys so much. Staying on the same page for now. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And Malcolm?
Thank you. The thing with the wedding, that definitely wasn't the first unfortunate incident. It wasn't the last. It's probably the best remembered by the most people, just because it happened in public. But without alcohol, I really. Living one day at a time, living in the moment is actually, I find it more difficult than I did when I was drinking. When I was drinking, I didn't have time to consider anything other than what was right in front of me. There was always some crisis to deal with, usually involving money, not always. I was definitely living in the moment. Really the same way, I suppose, that an animal lives in the moment. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for 3 years, and whereas before I was able to set everything aside to deal with my needs, it's really, if you want to treat people with consideration, if you care about them, if you care about what they're feeling, then it's necessary to think about things, to plan, to be considerate. I mean, that's what it's about. You need to think about things, and this involves thinking about what the consequences of my actions could be, what effect it could have on other people. And what I'm saying is I can sometimes get lost in this, and I start thinking about the future, which reminds me of the past. And I have to constantly reinitialize my mind to keep focused on the present. It's really living in the moment, living one day at a time is much more difficult now that I'm sober, because there's a lot going on that I never thought about before. I remember I had an experience. In a sense, my what happened to me really wasn't of the educational variety. In a way, I'm learning more all the time. But it began with I can remember the day I was trying to quit drinking again for the umpteenth time. In the interest of full disclosure, I should let you know that I was also in withdrawal from heroin. I was very, very uncomfortable. And there was a cat in the room with me, and no one else. This has something to do with the cat, I suppose, but really that's not all there is to it. I thought I was going to die, and there was crushing loneliness. I had been isolated for a long time, and at the time I described it as an awareness of a presence. And you know, I'd read the Big Book. I think I was trying to superimpose that experience on what was happening to me, because it's the only thing that really made sense. But looking back at it now, it wasn't so much that I became aware of a presence as that I was aware of the presence of everything. And this cat was part of it. The loneliness vanished. It was a remarkable thing. And there's a lot of power in this moment. And I did drink again after this, which was puzzling, but recognition of the power and knowing how to use it are not the same thing. And what I'm doing in what Alcoholics Anonymous is doing for me now is teaching me how to use that power. Debbie?
All right. So I love this line that I suddenly find myself easily able to control my desire for alcohol. I like to share a little story. You know, a lot of y'all have heard my story and have heard this story over and over again. But, you know, when I finally got serious about, you know, realizing I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable, I get a sponsor, I get a home group, I'm working the steps. Still working in the bar, but I'm doing what they're asking of me. And I remember, you know, we had a boat. I was still married at the time to the beer truck driver. And so we had a boat. We'd go out every weekend, and I'd be the sober boat driver, just like I'd be the designated driver, because now I'm sober. Everybody else is drinking and others. But anyway, the best part of boating is going to the restaurant and eating and pulling up to the dock and, you know, going to the restaurant. And so I did not lose the desire to drink right away, but I was working the steps, and I did have a sponsor. And this particular day, I'm just done. I'm watching everybody get drunk, and I decided I'm going to drink. I want to drink. And I ordered a drink, and I've been going to meetings by this time, I don't know, 6-9 months, I don't know. So I know the deal by now. I know what's going to happen if I take that drink, because I'd already tried this game before. And so instead of taking that drink, I got up and I went in the bathroom and I said, "Dear God, please don't let me take that drink." And it was probably the first sincere prayer I'd said in my life. Up until then, my sponsor had said, you get on your knees in the morning, ask him to help you not take a drink, get on your knees at night and thank him. And I would do that and say, this is Debbie, in case you don't know, I feel like a phony, I'm talking to a wall, please help me not take a drink today. And anyway, I had managed to get a couple of months together. And so I went in that bathroom and I said that honest prayer. And I came back and I didn't drink that drink. I didn't let anybody else drink that drink either because it's mine, but I didn't drink that drink. And I continued to go to my home group and to work with my sponsor and to continue the steps. And what I know today is that I have not had a desire to drink since I have completed the 12 steps the very first time around. And that I don't think about drinking today. I am definitely easily able to control my desire for drinking. And just a quickie too, to just let you know how it was in the early 80s, during that time before that, when I would call my sponsor, I want to drink, I want to drink, I want to drink. She'd say, Debbie, meet me at the bar, I'd buy your first one. So, you know, I'm not opposed to anybody taking every drink they need to drink to stay in this chair and be comfortable, because it's a miserable place to be if you're just not sure you belong here. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, moving on to our final reading tonight, and we are running a little short on time, so if you guys could just take a couple minutes to wrap up. Page XXX. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Malcolm?
Thanks, BJ. I'm not thinking about drinking either. And I haven't for a while. I'm around people who drink occasionally from time to time. I'm not tempted. The obsession seems to have been lifted. The problem now is the same problem I think I've always had, since the same problem I had before I started drinking. It's I still do this. It's a difficult mental. It's a difficult habit of mine to break. I live in this delusion that I'm separate from God and from you. I'm thinking, if my mind is on God, then and God is everything, and I do believe that God is everything, then I have to consider you too. And this is still, I feel that this is the truth. I do believe that God is everything. And I know this is the truth and I feel it, but it's still, you know, I looked at the world a very different way for a long time, and it's a difficult mental habit to break. And I know that there's certain things that I need to do. I'm looking forward to hearing about those things in the coming weeks. Thanks.
And I think this paragraph just kind of recaps what we've already said. So I'll pass it back to you, BJ. Thanks.
All right. Thank you guys so much. That was awesome. Very, very relatable. And everybody will have a chance to thank them after the meeting. So please stick around for that. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Are there any AA-related announcements at this time? You Feel free to unmute yourself and just start talking if you have one. Nobody. Well, we have one. We are hosting a speaker / Ask It Basket on Sunday nights at 7 p.m. And I honestly don't know who our speaker is going to be this Sunday. If anybody else in the home group does, maybe put that in the chat window if you're able to. But anyway, it's been really good. Somebody from out of town will tell their story from 7 to 8, and then there's a 30-minute opportunity to ask them questions. So we hope you guys will join us for that this Sunday. And that can be found under the link speaker/askitbasket, 7 p.m. on Sunday on the intergroup website. Simple Actions is a home group. Could all home group members please raise your hand? Thank you. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting to connect with any of the folks with their hands raised. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, someone will be available in the Zoom room after we close the meeting. Please stick around to talk with us or feel free to email us at info@simpleactions.net. And I got a message from somebody that the PayPal link that I posted isn't working. Jessica, would you be able to try to repaste that? Thank you. It might be something. I might have done something weird with mine. So we'll try that again. Sorry about that. And Amy Kay has volunteered to read a vision for you. I will put that up on the screen. Amy? Amy, you there?
I'm here. Yeah, I couldn't unmute. Anyway, the link does work because I donated during the meeting, and the speaker is Carla R. from Los Angeles.
Thank you.
All right, so anyway, here this is. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Amy. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thanks, Amy. And thanks to all who participated this evening, especially Debbie and Malcolm. Thanks, guys. That was so good. And now if everybody would like to unmute, we're going to end with the Lord's Prayer. And after that, I hope everybody will stick around to thank Debbie and Malcolm. All right, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.